Hi. First of all, thank you, Scott, for organizing this. If it was selfish of you to want to set it up, it's certainly selfish of me to have said this is great, and I really very much appreciate it. And thank you so much, Michael, for this criticism, and Todd as well, both of the criticism and the change of terrain. A lot has been said, and I'm going to try and see how to respond in this as brief a manner as possible in what follows. In some ways, certainly Todd's account, sorry, certainly Michael's account of what he sees as some of the problems of this project carries a number of concerns that I've very much had and that I'd wanted to respond to in advance. So the project you suggested is Whiggish, too Lovejoyan, decontextualized, and yet too dependent on Cambridge without being able to recognize it. It's triumphalist, yet it doesn't manage to do more than present a manner of thin, strained accounts of where transparency would fit. And to bring in one of Todd's points, it brings in perhaps too much of one discipline and not enough of the other, of others. I'm going to come to Todd's points in a minute. There's a way, so here's, let's go back to the context, and I'll try to change a little bit the tenor and direction of this. Context has structured historical work in the last 50 years, flatly put, in intellectual history in the following manner. We have a person, we treat that person as an intellectual, we look at their context, institutional, biographical, cultural, social, sometimes political too, and then frequently we make either political comments about their work, or we say how it is that this context explains what it is that they're thinking. We thus explain why it is that something takes place in France, or why somebody thinks within a specific framework. That sounds great for some projects. It has no bearing upon the function of concepts themselves. If you'd want to invert this, you could say that this is a 500-page book, of which 499 pages are about the context for transparency. But that would be a very flawed way of understanding what context is supposed to do, and a very profoundly wrong way of us trying to see what we want to do when we want concepts or terms or problems to do some work for us rather than to be explained by what is going on. And so, yes, I do think the concepts to some degree structure and are structured by what would traditionally be referred to as context. I don't think that concepts are units. On the contrary, I think that they're, you know, as per the web example, I think that they're like little points that are suspended from other ones that cannot operate on their own, that do not have a singularity and do not have a unity. And all the more so, I picked here a term that I very much enjoyed realizing as something that is not, strictly speaking, a concept. There is no single definition of the term. There is no direct relation between some of its uses and a broader, stronger understanding or definition of what a concept would be in this case. But there is a very elaborate valorization of it. There's a very clear valorization, and this has to do with the engrams as well. We can do as many engrams as we want to, but if in most places transparency is used as a positive ideal, and in some it's used in a much more complex manner, an engram will not give you any sort of value as to what the form of that would be. And so part of the idea in this was to say, why do people use a specific term in passing to describe something they find highly problematic? And the in passing happens all the way to this day sometimes. And that's something I find very peculiar. And so I pulled up very quickly, and because it's more fun than my trying to replicate it, an interview where Régis Debray spoke in September. And I'm not interested in Debray. I know relatively little about him, I suppose. But where he spoke in September, and he, in critique of Macron, for example, he would say something like, "Il fut un temps où l'on se fâchait d'être taxé de transparent, soit d'insignifiant, et puis encore d'être qualifié d'innocent, soit d'idiot. Les injures d'un jour sont les flatteries du lendemain. Personnellement, la seule personne tout entière ingéniosité, transparence, blancheur et candeur qu'il m'a été donné de croiser ici-bas, c'est l'orpheline des misérables. Et je n'ai plus imaginé Cosette en futur député, ministre ou président. Now, I'm not so interested in whether, to give you an example of this, I'm not interested in who de Braise, I'm not interested in whether or why he likes or doesn't like Macron. I'm interested in why a term comes to play this role, that instead of attacking Macron for something else, you would attack him for a pretense to transparence, either an illusion or an endorsement of that. And this structurally alters what it is that we think words can do and concepts can do. We can have a Cambridge School style of understanding concepts in which concepts would be fundamentally big. The ones we care for are relatively visible. They have to do with the state, they have to do with reason, they have to do with liberalism, they have to do with big names, the big names discuss them, lesser names discuss them as well and play a certain negotiatory position. But from my perspective, this is not quite that useful for a concept that doesn't play that kind of role, that is used broadly and generally and at the same time implicit in related terms, and in some respects engaged philosophically for that format. So what would I use as an example of this? Or what would I use to describe this as a form? I think the account, the duality that Todd brought in, the sort of demand of grappling in the dark with eliminating complexity, the lack of clarity as to when one is supposed to do this or what is supposed to happen, that demand is a key feature not only of, let's say, well, obviously not only of Algeria-oriented intellectual life in France, but it is very much a kind of demand both for speaking out and for trying to think longer, let's say, on different matters. It seems to me that similarly, the concepts where you said, Michael, the argument gets strained are actually decidedly concepts where transparency is being played out. Transparency is key, for example, in norm and normalization. It is key to the very fact of the règle de la méthode sociologique of Durkheim's. It is absolutely key to the elementary forms of religious life, to Halbach's work. It's explicit in these texts. And it is explicitly engaged by Canguilhem and later by Foucault as a key element of how to think about what the relation between norm, ideal, value, and normalization is. The same thing will go with the other ethnologists, whom I actually really very much remain very deeply interested in, partly because of his relation to colonial ethnography in the early years and later to paleontology, André Leroy-Gouron. There, too, the replay of a certain Durkheimian organicism gets staged around concerns about how does a society recognize itself, or how does a certain humanity recognize itself as transparent to itself. These matters are not altogether left on the side. And we would probably do some damage to an argument about concepts, metaphors, figures, if we couldn't actually say that things like the face, when they are engaged in matters of stability, clarity, visage, not the face, in English it actually loses that sense of the visage as carrying a person, as having the clarity, as having a whole long religious tradition and history of it, of seeing the face of God as a clear, you know, perhaps the clearest example of this. When they do get replayed, we couldn't possibly remove them from a discussion of this. And so the problem comes that I think you both raised, and which I think is really very fair. There is a lot that could be said in other disciplines here, and that is not said. There are a lot of other matters that I wish I could have explored, but where the argument would not go. In a way, you're asking me to talk about contexts that are less directly relevant to the use of the term. To rephrase that, yes, I do think that Bourdieu is a great case for this. I do think that someone like Georges Condominas and his engagement with Vietnam, his writing about Vietnam, have a lot to do with this. But I cannot make the connection as clear and closely organized as it could be, as I can make it in these other forms. That is to say, if I want to talk about everyday language and about, you know, a certain more disciplinary engagement with that everyday language, a philosophical conceptualization, a kind of clear set of engagements of that language, there I needed to privilege certain spaces over others. And that was not necessarily a very satisfactory, that did not lead to very satisfactory results a lot of the time. But if the story would be about a concept and a word, that was going to be partly the trick or the concern. With Bourdieu, you're absolutely right, by the way. There's no, I mean, his absence from the book is a sort of, the absence of the entire understanding of literary field, for example, is a complete collapse of this argument. On historians, I do think that historians, despite our usual argument regarding the centrality of the Annales school, I do think that there the discussion would have been too fragmented to bring in or to manage in. And so that there I would sort of hold off a little bit on them. But for the most part, I wanted to suggest that even if I have a strong objection to points about context, even if I do think that part of the effort of the book is to perfect a kind of context so that it doesn't exist anymore, to make it participate in the discussions of the term and in the intellectuals that we have in mind, then at the same time, there isn't exactly, and I don't mean this as a cop-out, there isn't exactly a methodology here. I'm not sure, and I think I've said this repeatedly in the last while when I've spoken about the book, I'm not entirely sure that I would ever do this again in quite the same way, or that I would use it to say, this is the way that you should proceed to do it. It is from my perspective, and this web argument is from my perspective, a way of saying, here's how I can imagine this operating. I do think it's useful because you can talk about a lot of things that are related, a lot of different domains that are related, a lot of different or related problems, and to fuse them into a certain account of what it is that even structures, not only, you said concept, structure, context, but also in this case, what it is that structures individual forms of thinking. That is to say, when someone like Foucault writes about transparency with extraordinary precision in Les Mots et les Choses, why would that be the focus of attention? And how would I operate into understanding that? How would I find another space for thinking similar sets of problems where a substantive problem and a methodological problem come into play in the same form? So from my perspective, transparency is less an overarching concept or an idea. It is rather, let's say, a peculiar sort of superficial effect, one that is carried along with others in a space where we don't have traditional historical agency and where we don't exactly know what we're always doing, where we easily revert back to methods that we've had in hand for a long enough time. The other way to put it would come, and here the Lovejoy, I'll close on the Lovejoy, in terms of thinking, I'll close on the Lovejoy, is that from my perspective, again, what was less interesting were the philosophers as philosophers, rather than I cared much more about them as conveyors of a certain set of meanings that is not carried in the argument, and yet is carried by the argument over and over. Gilles Deleuze says somewhere that, quote, it is always a matter of unseating the ideas, hence the Lovejoy, of showing that the incorporeal is not high above, but is rather at the surface, that it is not the highest cause, but the superficial effect par excellence, and that it is not essence, but event. I only found this quote quite recently after the book, but it carries exactly the sense that I have. We cannot pretend that words, individual concepts, have agency. But we can tell a story of a certain period and a certain set of problems, including their own history, not by reducing them to the way or approaching them from a complete outside, in which they don't play a key role in their own development, they and the concepts around them, but rather by approaching them as a set of mechanisms, as an assemblage, as a kind of fractal for a broader social or cultural or political or what will you, depending on the case, organization, institutional as well, where we would not treat them as though they're somehow above or relating to a context, but where they would be revealed and would reveal that that quote-unquote context, whatever it comes to be, that framework or that fractal or that space in which they operate just as much. I want to say this by way of thanking you both, because these are not, again, I want to be light-footed when we talk about matters of method. If on the one hand this feels very exciting to me to have to engage with a criticism, it's also in that exact spirit that I'm not necessarily promising that I know exactly what it is that I'm doing in these terms or that anybody else does. That's part of the idea. I wanted to say one last thought regarding queer thought with Todd's comment. I do think that you're absolutely right on the point on camp, and this is there are many, many, many spaces outside where this would go. But the version would be that for every figure that we have that writes in one direction, we have figures that write in the exact opposite or use the terms in that term in the U.S. in a very different one. So that would not necessarily, with a different valorization, so that would not necessarily as such offer a space like this peculiar moniker of post-war France, which of course is, you know, hardly an essential, clear-cut, organized post something moment, but rather can be something more fun and more present in this in-between form, that it evolves together with a concept as it comes through. Anyway, thank you, and I hope this is more useful than anything.
Panel. The criticisms were really interesting. I just want to say, at least my personal impression, I thought Stefanos' response to that was one of the greatest stand-up methodological self-defenses I've ever heard. And I think it also compares well even to the quality of writing on methodological issues that you find, for example, in the Cambridge School, which, frankly, I think that the quality of their methodological reflections, not the work per se, is overrated. And it's one of the reasons that I think it hasn't had such a big impact on French history. And I could talk more about that, but I only want to ask one question and not be one of these persons who ask two questions and make three comments. So for Stefanos, based on what I heard, the only feature of your book that struck me as problematic, and it didn't come out of your own discourse, it came from the summaries, is the tendency to see what came before the 20th century as revolving around sort of naive conceptions of transparency. And I'm just wondering if you could speak to that, because, all right, so as a scholar of the Enlightenment, I think the motto of the Enlightenment is dare not to know. The limits of knowledge is what it's all about. There was reference to Kant as believing that, you know, our concepts and reality are totally in sync with each other, and I'm just wondering, wondering about that. One could say that the whole development of the novel in Europe is based on the recognition that we can't comprehend the world as a whole, so we have to engage in some thick description. And then the novel, in turn, affects other disciplines. And I happen to be working on Tocqueville. He describes himself as a painter in America as a vast tableau that can't be taken in all at once. So when he describes the condition of the blacks in Native Americans at the end of Volume 1, he says, well, so far I've talked about it from this perspective, but there are many perspectives from which we can view America. Now we just have to shift and focus on inequality. And there are many examples. When Starobinsky described Rousseau in terms of transparency, it was to draw attention to something exceptional about his thought. When he wrote about Montaigne, it was to focus on a philosopher of obstruction. So are you taking the 20th century thinkers at face value when they see themselves as pioneers in the exploration of epistemological limits?
So the way that I would put it is that this was actually a bit of a methodological effort in the book. It was to say nothing about the any period described by these authors except through their own particular lenses. And the reason for that is that, of course, transparency doesn't have a singular history. I have some reference points. So, for example, as Michael said, there's an opening section that says, look, this is the past of transparency as it's understood. But all of those are marked by way of the citations made to them in roughly the post-45 period. Why would one do that? The first is that, as you said, the Enlightenment is not simply an account, or the rise of the novel. This is not simply an account of everybody goes to the transparent, then suddenly 1945 comes, and a bunch of people decide let's just change course, and that's the enemy somehow. But it was to say that if Descartes and Rousseau are used in the post-World War II period, they're used with particular attention to the transparency of the cogito and quote my, the Rousseau quote, my soul transparent as crystal. The fun part about Starobinsky, in a way, is that, and so this is what opens the book for me, is not that he goes to Rousseau for transparency, but that he suggests that once Rousseau achieved transparency of himself, he became completely paranoid because all of the shadows now could be projected to the outside world. And that in that regard, the account of Rousseau could be doubled onto an account of contemporary theories of psychosis, which then get replayed over and over. So from my perspective, references to the past are not useful in a story like this, just because of the past being there, just because of whatever had been done. But only
Starobinsky himself can become part of the story.
Yes. He's the opening. He's the opening of the book.
That's good.
But that's very much the sense of how these things would go. Yes, so that it's not about la transparence, but about l'obstacle, which is the sort of classic Bachelardian notion that then becomes really key for this. I think that telling us a history of those accounts of history, so to speak, which are not to be treated for their scientific pretense, but for their capacity to shape a conception of the past and the way that they reflect conceptions of the past. That was the goal. So I, you could say that this book says not a word about the Enlightenment or about Descartes, even if there's a lot of material on perceptions of them. Thank you, though.
I'm Rebecca Spang from Indiana, and like Dan Gordon, I'm a sort of tourist here from the 18th and 19th century context. But my question, unlike Dan's, is less about the relation to history and more about method, because I'm completely sympathetic with the idea that contexts are not simply givens. Contexts are frames that historians draw, and historians need to be aware that they are doing the framing. And far too often that doesn't happen in a particular way of saying, oh, well, we know what the relevant context is, and we'll just sort of work through them the way you described it, like a set of nested boxes. Mm-hmm. We'll do the person, we'll do the milieu, we'll do the culture, we'll do the society, we'll do the politics, then we're done. So I'm very sympathetic with that. And thinking about what it would be to write a history of words and concepts where we don't know what the context is, right? and that the question is how can we let the relations between the words and the concepts give us a new idea mm-hmm. of what context might mean, reminded me, actually, and this is probably going to seem like a stretch, of the work that literary scholars in particular do with distance reading. Mm-hmm. And so if you're Ted Underwood and you take all the words in English literature in the 19th century and dump them into a computer and have the computer map the relations, it's going to tell you that these words cluster together. And if the words that cluster together are horse, carriage, bus, cities, that's actually boring because you know what that's about. But if the cluster of words is horse, cloud, valley, obstacle, then you're like, I don't know what that's about. And so that's where you should look, because that's a pattern that can be recognized, that we, with our normal human ways of identifying what a context is, mm-hmm. we're just like, I want to talk about urban transport in the 19th century, so I'm going to talk about horses and buses. Does this seem at all sympathetic with what you're doing, or is it just a completely different...
I don't know enough about it, but I'm very warm to the idea of this, yes, that there's... Yes, that was about reconstructing what the reference framework would be.
Yeah.
So I'm going to use reference framework rather than context for anyone follows. But so reconstructing a reference framework in order to be able to tell the story of a cluster of terms or concepts or images or, you know, metaphors as they come. Those, that would be something that I have in mind. Again, I don't know that the computer can give you that valorization. But I'm sure that it can do it, if not now, then later, as well as we can. In a way, what it does do is...
I think what the computer does is it tells you there's a not there.
Sure.
And then it's your job, like, to figure out, as you were describing, you know, how the knots and the threads... But it can help you to identify knots that you haven't seen otherwise, because you just keep looking at things through the same inherited frames.
Yes, very very much so. And there, that would be the hope to have, you know, as Michael closed, not a concept that is a kind of dominant concept, but a concept that's the most unlikely and yet most pervasive somehow, or a set of them. And I'm not pretending that this is what the book... It made it possible to talk about certain things I really wanted to, or certain figures I really wanted to in the process. But, you know, I'm sure that there's a better term. I just couldn't figure out what that... I wasn't looking for that. Like to, in the process, I would end up now looking for something like that.
Better term than web or not? Is that what you mean?
Oh, no, than transparency. That I didn't... It never sort of occurred to me that, you know, I am going to look for the best concept to do this. It was not. It was... I was writing about transparency, and suddenly the sort of... complexity of its relevance became sort of all the more striking. And then the other side, the sort of the contrastive sense to the way that it would be used on separate occasion on current matters. Just, but I think that's about it. You're right.
But it just bounced off this. You know, I'm really interested in this. Like Foucault maps out in the Archaeology of Knowledge this contrast between memory, and for him, memory are the stories we have about the past and the monuments. And the monuments are possible through, he suggests, archival study or serial studies, and suddenly you see this thing that has disappeared that mattered to people at the time, that has a coherence to it. And so anyone can think of this too, just in the basic, you know, fantasy of doing archival work and running again and again. Like people are putting things in boxes and suddenly you're like, this isn't of interest, but at a certain moment it's still there, or this word is still there, and you need to pay attention to it. I mean, I think that that mode of thinking is really interesting. I mean, of trying to figure out what, as a historian, what clusters together in ways that we don't already predict or know.
One thing that I was surprised didn't come up was the fact that in some ways it looks a lot like an older form of philology, and maybe that's a connection to Lovejoy. And there were lots of moments where I think maybe close to Michael reading the book, I kept thinking, all right, transparency is lost. I can't really find the thread. And then there's a huge block quotation in damn it, Congulem is done talking about transparency, and then it ties everything together.
And block quotations are a bad decision.
But
they save me from the trouble of actually having to talk about you, like to sort of spell it out. I can do something on the side, and then the thing spells it out for you. You just say, okay, that's good.
Yeah, but I think like the distant reading is another way of doing that. So you're tracking like who's citing who, who's reading who, and then who's picking up on transparency and modifying it. And you can sort of do that the same way with n-grams and the big computer stuff. So I think there are just different angles of getting at the sort of same ways that words and these concepts sort of shift over time that way. Mm. Yeah. I get the microphone.
Amy Hobson from Adams State University. I wonder if you could just expand on a brief comment that you made. I've been researching the intellectual relationships between American scholars and the annals, and you mentioned that the centrality of the annals, the discussion would be too fragmented to include, and I just wondered if you could expand briefly.
Apologies about that. I think that was poor phrasing on my part. My sense was that, on the one hand, we have a story about the centrality of the annals, and I had no comment really to make on that, other than that a lot of the post-war discussions are not controlled around a kind of centrality of the annals versus others. Much as, for example, the discussions that Todd brought in before, in which there can be seemingly minor or off-centered engagements, invocations, little conflicts that then acquire outsized significance when they have to do with a concept like this. So I have no comment on the centrality of the annal. It was what I would say. These discussions would be too fragmented to fit into that story, and I couldn't to fit into a story that would be an overview of the historical discipline, if you want, in post-war France. And so I didn't feel like this was something where I could make a substantial comment beyond, you know, the little invocations of transparency in Fevre, for example, and others. I couldn't see there being a threat rather than something else. So, yes, not a very helpful point. Sorry.
Though, unfortunately, I think our time's up, but there's a coffee break where we can continue everything.
Cool.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, guys.
Thank you. Thank you.